I'm Michael Brennis, and this is the Showbiz Roundup. Jeb Bishop has been an important member of the improvised music scenes in Chicago, Boston, and Chicago again. Along the way, he's figured out how to sustain his musical efforts, which are, by the way, some of the most engaging anywhere, over the long haul. And the trombone trio he's currently on the road with is one of the most exceptional. My guest today, Jeb Bishop. Welcome to the show, Jeb. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's start by talking about this trombone trio in particular. As usual, we have some concerns about immigration, so I'll let you introduce the others in whatever way you want.
Okay.
You've been performing with this trio since, I think, 2016.
Yeah.
How did this group get its start, and what else would you like to tell us about the trio?
Okay, so this is a trio of me, Jeb Bishop, I play the trombone, together with two German trombonists, both of whom are named Matthias, and both of whose last names start with the letter M. So I'm just going to call them Matthias M and Matthias M. One of them lives in Cologne and the other lives in Berlin. So there's Cologne Matthias and Berlin Matthias. And I had worked together with Matthias from Cologne in a project probably also in 2016, maybe 2015, a large group called Spin Effects that's led by a guy from Amsterdam named Tobias Klein, a German saxophone player who lives in Amsterdam. So we met and worked together in that. And the other Matthias, the one from Berlin, I had met on a trip to Berlin, but I don't think we played together then around the same time. Anyway, there was after I had worked with the Cologne Matthias, we talked about putting a project together, and he already had a duo with the guy from Berlin. So they talked about making it a quartet with me and Johannes Bauer, who at the time was still active and performing. And then there's the whole thing with the names, because their initials were both MM, so they had this MM squared duo, and we thought it would be partly, you know, clever or whatever to add two guys with the initials JB to that. So it was going to be this quartet show in Cologne. And we set up the date. At that time, by the time we did that, it was already generally known that Johannes was very ill, but he was still performing and recording and doing whatever he could do. And he, you know, agreed to do the date when we told him about it. But then as we got closer to the date, he had to back out of it because his health wouldn't permit him to perform anymore. And it turned out, you know, through one of life's weird coincidences, that the day that he actually passed away was the day of the performance. So We played as a trio that night in Cologne at the Stadtgarten. And of course, it was dedicated to Johannes. And there's a recording of the concert, and that was released as our first CD, which we dedicated to him also. So it's called Concert for Hannes, or in German, Konzert für Hannes. Hannes is how he was known to his friends. So that ended up being a dedication to him, to Johannes Bauer, because of the circumstances of the performance and the recording. And but the group was, you know, we really liked playing together, and we decided to organize a tour in Europe for the first tour we did in Europe was in 2019. So those guys put together mostly, I think I instigated one or two of the shows, but mostly those guys put together a tour of, I think, 11 dates at that time, including a couple of festivals and winding up in Berlin. And we got good live recordings of the first show, which was in Antwerp in Belgium at a festival, and the last show in Berlin. And selections from those recordings turned out to be our second CD, called From A to B, meaning from Antwerp to Berlin, basically. So that's out. And then last year, about a year ago, we did another European tour. And again, we played a few festivals and played around Europe. And maybe it was 10 dates, something like that. This time we didn't get any live recordings from the tour that I know of, or we're not contemplating releasing that. But we wanted to the next step to be a tour of the United States. So I've been working over the last few months on putting together a tour in the U.S. Those guys got some grant money to help finance it. I've been talking to different venues. We're going to start in Boston and go to a New York, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Detroit, and then Madison. And then we're in Chicago for a bit doing a show with the trio, and then those guys are going to do some related things while they're here. And then Matthias from Cologne is going to head back home, and then the Berlin guy and I are going to head to New Orleans, and we're going to play a couple of shows in New Orleans. So all the tour dates are up at my website, jebbishop.com, and there are some Facebook events that you can find too related to the tour. But at my website, there's the tour dates and venues, and also a couple of videos that were made during our previous tours, so you can get a sense of what the band is like.
I've seen the name Bone Crusher in some of the material relating to this trio. Is that a different entity, or is that something to do with this trio as well?
Now it is a different entity. I mean, I think the first tour we did, we called it Bone Crusher Tour. And then Matthias from Cologne organized a project with more trombones and also some percussion and maybe some other instruments too. But that he started calling that Bone Crusher. And so he's using that name for that trombone project. So we decided to drop using that name for the trio. So for the moment, we're just using our names to identify the trio.
That's a worthy name. I mean, a lot of people do that.
Yeah.
It's very identifiable.
I mean, I really like the Bone Crusher name, but I understand his choice there. So
yeah. Although you do run into those immigration problems.
Yeah.
Advertising the name.
That makes it difficult. Yeah. I mean, fingers crossed those guys aren't going to bring horns with them. I have some horns that I'm lining up for them to use. Without going into it too much, you know, hopefully it'll be okay. Yeah.
I hear about that situation frequently, but I don't think I've ever heard of someone running into problems with that kind of under the radar sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I've known people who have had issues. It happens. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to start naming names or talking about it too much or anything, but it is a concern that you have to watch out for.
So given the nature of the trombone, you change pitch using a slide. There's no guide to find the slide positions. There's a lot of responsibility left to the player in terms of tuning. I know trombonists can play microtonally with some ease, but how challenging is it to stay in tune among the three of you if you decide you want to play in tune with each other? Can you keep in tune to an absolute pitch, or do you adjust to each other to stay sort of in relative tune?
Well, in general, when you learn to play the trombone in, you know, what I'll call more conventional settings, I mean, that's part of what you learn. And if you become more successful at it, that's part of how you learn to play the instrument, to play with other instruments. I mean, you do have a lot of fine control over the intonation in a way that most other wind instruments don't have quite so easily. I mean, a lot of string instruments that don't have frets have the same capability to, you know, easily make small adjustments. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of playing in tune that underlies your question kind of sounds to me like it's based on a conception of what's considered in tune in a very particular framework of what musicians call 12-tone equal temperament, meaning that all the notes are the same distance apart, the way they standardly are on a piano keyboard, for example. But that's really only one way to think about intonation. And even in like older music, if you get really into older music, it's like from the Renaissance, probably even the Baroque, there were, before the advent of 12-tone equal temperament, which was not always the accepted standard, there were a lot of different ways to think about intonation. The distances between the notes were not thought of as all being the same. And there are different systems even now that people in those areas of practice use it. I mean, it's a really technical subject, and I don't know that much about it actually. But my point is that the idea of playing in tune is itself pretty flexible and open to interpretation. So when we play our music, we're really not even starting from a standpoint of 12-tone equal temperament. You know, I mean, we'll get into areas where, because we're all experienced players, I mean, we listen to each other and hear what's going on, and we can all make decisions about things that are related to that. Like, let's say we end up on some kind of triad, you know, that can be tuned in a lot of different ways. If you play a, let's say, a major triad on a piano keyboard that's tuned with all the notes equally spaced, the third of the chord is going to be in a different place than if you do it in a different tuning system. And a lot of people think that the chord actually sounds better, and in a certain sense related to the overtone series, more correct if you lower the third a little bit. So again, that's a huge rabbit hole we could go down. But the point is that musicians learn to think about that more flexibly, and there isn't any one thing that counts as being in tune. There's music that, if you approach it too much from that angle, it's actually bad for the music for it to be, to quote, in tune in that conventional sense, you know. I mean, I've heard music, I don't want to, like, I'm reluctant to put anybody down, you know, so I'll just say that I've heard, like, traditional music played by great virtuosos, you know, on recordings where they play, like, for example, traditional Appalachian music, but they play it with, you know, perfect classical intonation, and to me that is bad for the music. Or there's a lot of jazz, frankly, that I think would be, you know, ill-served by cleaning up the intonation, quote-unquote, in that way. So intonation is one of the expressive means that you use in music, and it's I don't agree with the idea that intonation that departs from this particular equal temperament standard is wrong or bad, you know. I mean, to put it a lot more succinctly, there's a famous quote from Ornette Coleman where he said, you can play sharp in tune and you can play flat in tune, because people were questioning his intonation when he first came to light. People were saying, oh, that guy plays out of tune. And one of Ornette's great innovations was to think about what we call unison and intonation in different ways, you know. And this quote of his really sums up this idea about using intonation as an expressive means, I think. But you hear it, I mean, that predates Ornette Coleman for sure. You hear it in all kinds of jazz, you hear it in blues for sure, mm-hmm. all kinds of traditional music. I mean, you know, intonation is not this thing that has to be measured against this absolute external standard. It has to do with the musical aesthetic results.
Are the three of you making decisions in the moment in those terms? Like, I know you play, some of your music is sort of, and you've described it as sort of drone-like. You know, you have moments in your improvisations that are sort of drone-like. Are you making these sort of, these decisions, these minute sort of intonation decisions on the fly to achieve a certain, you know, a certain end to this sound?
Yeah, I mean, I really like that sound. Like, if we're talking about a drone, let's say there's a part where we're droning around a pitch, which happens sometimes. I mean, I think it's a great sound when you get like that kind of, you know, swarm of bees sound or whatever by adjusting the pitch against the other guys. It like can get a little bit, you start to get some beats happening, you change the pitch so you're not quite the same pitch as the other, you know, it. And that creates a lot of, because of the acoustic properties of sound, when you put pitches close together that aren't quite the same, it generates a lot of overtones and makes, in a way, a much richer sound, right? So when pitches are completely the same pitch played together, you don't get that same kind of generation of overtones. And so it's really a different sound event, you know? And yeah, it is very easy to play around with that on the trombone because of the slide. So, you know, that's something that we take advantage of, because why wouldn't you, you know?
Right. That's one of the advantages of this configuration.
Yeah, but I mean, every, you know, other instrumentalists do the same thing. There are certainly ways to bend the pitch around on just about every instrument. You know, you can even do it on piano and vibraphone, I think, with certain kinds of attack techniques. You can get the pitch to bend in certain ways, or you can use like clusters and half steps to suggest a pitch bend. That was Thelonious Monk did that a lot, the way I hear it, for example.
You had something of a circuitous path up until you arrived on the scene in Chicago in the early 90s. You started by studying classical trombone at Northwestern and ended up becoming a philosopher studying in Belgium.
Yeah.
And along the way, you had some very interesting musical experiences. Are there any that stand out to you as particularly formative?
Yeah, I was studying classical trombone at Northwestern, and I made it. This was like my first 2 years out of high school in college as an undergraduate at Northwestern University, but like right up the street from where I live now in Rogers Park in Chicago. Northwestern is just over the line in Evanston. And at that time I was a classical musician. That's what I wanted to do. That's what all my training was. I liked jazz. I had an interest in jazz, but I didn't have any kind of training in jazz. I got my feet wet with that a little bit at Northwestern, but Northwestern was not, it didn't have any kind of official jazz program. It did have some jazz ensembles, and I took a course in big band arranging while I was there. So that was actually important for me to do some writing for, you know, a jazz ensemble in that way. Think about like some harmonic stuff and orchestration and form and things like that. Then they brought in an external guy to do some like extracurricular sort of rudiments of jazz theory stuff for people who are interested. So I did some of that. But then I decided I didn't want to be a classical musician. So after 2 years, I quit, dropped out of that program. I went back to my native North Carolina, and I was going to pursue engineering studies at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, which is my hometown, which is actually a really good school for engineering. But at the same time, not long after landing there, I was still really interested in music, but I got really interested in what was the sort of beginnings of the punk rock scene in Raleigh in North Carolina. So I was fascinated by this music that was, you know, pretty much a polar opposite in some ways of all my classical training up to then. I mean, I was young then, but these were kids who were even younger than me. A lot of them were still in high school, mostly with no, you know, formal training or knowledge of music at all, but they really wanted to create this music. And it was this really genuinely underground thing. There was this cassette that came out around the time called the No Core cassette. Of No Core was like North Carolina hardcore. That was what they called it. So this is like early, like what ended up getting called hardcore punk. An old friend of mine from high school was a guy who had gone to Berkeley to study jazz guitar, and he had left after 1 year there, and he was doing engineering at NC State. So he and I started playing punk rock in this scene. We kind of got into this milieu, and we had this band that was called Stillborn Christians because we wanted to piss off evangelicals in the Bible Belt. The music we tried to, because we were coming at it from this angle, right? I mean, he had had some jazz training. I had had some classical training. We had this different, whole different take on music than the punk rock kids who were younger than us in a way. So we actually tried to find ways to incorporate other musical ideas into that music, which meant things like using dissonant guitar voicings, having the bass and guitar not do the same thing all the time. So there was that. And that was a really important thing for me also in the sense of it was like this really underground community. And this music was really coming out of this community of people who, it was a local thing. It was very grassroots. It was people doing this music because they really wanted to and finding this alternative way to make their own culture because they didn't like the culture that they were being handed by, you know, mainstream society. So that appealed to me. I really liked that aspect of it. And there were shows like at people's houses. There were shows in clubs to some extent. We didn't do a lot of touring with that band, but we did a little bit of recording just locally. I mean, that band, you know, broke up after not too long. And I went off to study philosophy in Belgium not long after that. I don't know. I guess that's all I'll say about that. But also at that time, I was, you know, there were some great local used record shops around the area, and I was picking up jazz records. But also, I was interested in more avant-garde stuff, more like the stuff that I do now, I guess. So I got some Anthony Braxton records, some Ornette Coleman records, Art Ensemble of Chicago records. I would try to pick things up that looked interesting. I think I even got that Music Improvisation Company record on ECM, which is Derek Bailey and Evan Parker and Jamie Muir. And that was like my first exposure to like what you could call European free improvisation. And at that, you know, the time I got that record, I really didn't get that one. That was like too out for me. You know, I liked free jazz, but even that I was trying to get my head around. So 1984, I went to Belgium to study philosophy because in the meantime, I decided I didn't want to study engineering. And in the library at the school, I by chance happened upon some philosophy books, and I thought this was really interesting and I wanted to do that. So I was a philosophy major by then. I went to do this year in Belgium because I wanted to spend a year in Europe if I could. And then while I was there in 1984, 85, a lot of music came through there that I went to go see, including the Braxton Quartet with Mark Dresser. No, it wasn't Mark Dresser. It was John Lindbergh, because it was a really early version of it. But it was Jerry Hemingway and Marilyn Kristel and John Lindbergh. And that concert really made a big impression on me. I saw Ornette Coleman's Primetime, classic lineup of that, also made a huge impression on me. I saw a great duo concert by Steve Lacy and the East German pianist Ulrich Gumpert. There was this little club in Brussels called The Planet that hasn't been there for a long time, a really tiny little place. And I saw a number of great shows there, and that was one of those. I saw this show with Joseph Jarman and Don Moyer from the AACM, together with Craig Harris on trombone and Essiet on bass. I saw that at The Planet. That was a really great show. I also saw things like, I went to see the Philip Glass Ensemble. They did a concert that I went to see. This guy, Garrett List, who was a trombonist who had worked with the Dutch guys some and had worked with Braxton. He was a teacher at the conservatory in Liège in Belgium, not far from where I was studying. And he came through and did a show like in this unheated shed in the wintertime. But it was him, like an action painter. So this guy was painting and Garrett List was improvising on trombone through some electronics, like layering stuff. And I talked to him for a minute after that show and told him I played trombone. And he said, oh, well, you should come visit this improvisation class that I teach at the conservatory. So I was like, okay, I'll do that. So I got on the train and I went to Liège and visited his, I went and bugged him at home first. I went over there and I had some like little duet I had tried to write that we didn't even play, but he was like, you know, my kid is sleeping right now, so we can't play any music, but why don't you come to this class at the school? So then I did that. I went to the class. And that was really the first time I tried to do any free improvisation myself. So that was important, you know. And that would have been 1985, I guess, in Liège. After that year, I went back to North Carolina. And I had all this stuff in my head, but there wasn't anybody around there that had similar interests in music really like that. But there was still a lot of rock music that I liked going on there. So I played in rock bands and did that for a few years. Look, I'm going on too long about all this, so I'll just stop right there. But that's the formative experiences, if you want to know, were like these concerts. In the punk rock thing was formative because it got me away from my classical mindset and into this idea that you can make your own thing. And the improvised music stuff that I saw in Belgium was really important and came at a time. I'll mention one other thing, though, which is that while I was still at Northwestern as an undergraduate, the Art Ensemble of Chicago played a concert at the concert hall there, which is called Pick Steiger Concert Hall. And I went to see that, and that really blew my head off, too. That was an amazing concert that I still remember pretty clearly.
Yeah, I found the Art Ensemble of Chicago to be one of the most influential group of musicians at that time for me too. We're of a similar age, and they
This would have been 1981 or two when I saw them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not long after that, I got one of the records I got in Raleigh was their record Fanfare for the Warriors.
Yes,
which is a really great album, and I listened to that a lot. That, you know, it's funny with all these records and these experiences, because I'll go back now and like let's say I haven't listened to Fanfare for the Warriors in a long time, and I'll pull it out now and put it on, and it really like, I hear this, I hear this whole other dimension in it, you know, or I have this whole other experience of it than I did when I was 24 or whatever, you know. And that music is so, you know, rich and inexhaustible. You can keep coming back to it for your whole life and find new things in it, I guess.
Right. And do you ever go back to such recordings and hear things that you go, oh, I really absorbed that, you know, and I can hear that in my own playing now?
Yeah, probably.
Too much analysis, perhaps.
Well, I mean, I feel too close to my sources to talk objectively about my influences, you know. But another record that I got, this was a little later in the 90s, early 90s. I actually went back to Belgium and studied philosophy there again, but really I was trying to learn French. But around the early 90s, I got a copy of Elements of Surprise by Anthony Braxton and George Lewis. And I listened to that one a ton. And I think that record in particular, like George Lewis's trombone playing on that, but especially on that recording, had a lot of influence on the way I tried to play the trombone later, because it was a little while after that that I started really trying to play the trombone in improvised music, a few years after that. And so that was a real, you know, point of departure for me. And I could also mention like some Roswell Rudd recordings and the Paul Rutherford solo record, The Gentle Harm of the Bourgeoisie. Those also were things I was trying to emulate.
I know you performed on electric bass and guitar in some of the stuff you're doing in North Carolina, and then again in Chicago. And I understand that you even set the trombone aside for a while.
In around 1989, I left. I'd been in Raleigh doing this rock music stuff from about 86 to 89. And I left to go to graduate school in philosophy in Arizona at first in 89. And starting from then, I really didn't play the trombone at all. I'd been playing it a little bit in North Carolina, but not in any serious way. But then I didn't touch it at all for the time I was in philosophy graduate school, which was about 4 years. And then when I finally quit that in Chicago in 1993, 94, I was starting to try to play improvised music around here, at first on electric bass and electric guitar. And I thought pretty quickly, well, you know, I mean, these are instruments that I'm pretty technically limited on because I just, you know, I picked them up so I could play rock music on them and I don't have any kind of fundamental training on them. But I am a musician and I figured out how to do some things on them. But so that's what it is. But I do understand the trombone a lot better because of all my training on that. So I got the trombone back and I started trying to work with that again in around 93 or 94. And before that, you know, you could say there were about 10 years where I certainly didn't work on the trombone or try to play improvised music on the trombone, or, you know, I wasn't focusing on it in any way for about 10 years up until about, you know, 93, 94 around then. So yeah, I put it away and I came back to it. But when I came back to it, I'd been away from it long enough that my whole prior conception of what I'd learned how to play it was completely classically based. And I was able to finally get away from that. And with all these extra experiences I had from, you know, from those kind of punk rock ideal of, look, you just make music with the means you have, and it's not about the technique, to these like exposures to all these different ideas about improvisation and creating music in the moment from scratch and having it be about, you know, things, aspects of music other than a certain kind of harmony, for example. I had all these ideas in my head and that I didn't have before, you know, so I came back to the trombone with a really different mindset, you know. And then it took some time of playing it with other people and really starting to try to practice it again and get some facility back and to get new kinds of facility on it that I had never had before. This was where, for example, trying to copy George Lewis came in, you know, because George Lewis basically innovated all of these ways to play the trombone that I thought were really incredible. And I was like, well, I'm going to see if I can emulate that to some extent. And, you know, you can probably hear that in some of what I do. I mean, I owe him, like a lot of trombonists, I'm sure I owe him a huge debt in terms of, you know, showing the way towards some new things you can do with that instrument.
As of last year, you're back in Chicago after 10 years in Boston. You were in Chicago for 20 years, beginning in the early 90s. So one, what prompted you to leave Chicago in 2012? And two, you've mentioned the cost of living in Boston being an issue. What precipitated your return to Chicago?
Yeah, well, we did. My wife and I left Chicago in 2012, partly for reasons related to her job. her job had kind of like hit a dead end here. She's a medical librarian and she also has a degree in public health. So she took this more public health related job in North Carolina at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, or associated with that. And then I had like family reasons for going. My dad was nearing the end of his life and I wanted to be closer to him for that. So we relocated to North Carolina. And we were there for 2.5 years. My dad passed at the end of 2012 and we inherited some money. We ended up buying a house in Durham. We had considered some other relocation options, but we ended up staying around there for a while and got this house in Durham. And we were in North Carolina for a total of about 2.5 years. And then her job there also was, you know, good, but running into some issues. And musically for me, there were some good things that happened in North Carolina. And there's some musicians there that I found and encountered that I really liked. And I had a good time there, but it kind of wasn't enough for me in terms of the, you know, level of activity in the scene. I mean, one thing that happened there was I made a connection with Eugene Chadbourne because he was coming to Raleigh for a while and doing regular shows at a place called Neptune's, which is a bar underneath a music venue called King's in Raleigh. And yeah, there was a group there with some improvisers from the area, some musicians that, you know, we did regular shows there for a bit. So that was a really good connection to make, to get to work with him. So. And there were some connections that have been sustained with some of the other musicians there too. The viola player named Dan Rucha is also a composer, and a bassist named David Menestre, who has done quite a bit of recording with different projects, but he has kind of an overarching thing called Polly Orchard and he does different records under that title. So with both of those guys, I made records and did some touring even after I left North Carolina. Anyway, after 2.5 years in North Carolina, my wife got a good medical librarian job in Boston, so we decided to move there. I had connections musically in Boston already with people like Pandalis Karayorgas, pianist, and Jorrit Dykstra, reed player, and Nate McBride, who I had worked with a lot in Chicago, had moved to Boston before that, so he was there when I got there. And then I got to know a lot of other great musicians in Boston, too. I mean, Boston has a lot of really good players. It's a little bit of an issue there with venues, partly related to the fact that everything is so expensive there. You pretty much always, not always, but very often have to rent a venue if you want to put a show on. And then it's hard to even not lose money just to play a show, you know. But I did do regular shows there with a lot of people, you know. There was a guy named Eric Rosenthal, a really great improvising drummer, and he had a regular series at the Lily Pad, so I played on that quite a bit with Jorrit and Pandalis and Nate and Luther Gray on drums. We had a band called Cutout, which was also kind of part of a regular series at the Lily Pad, so we did that a lot. And I met a lot of other improvisers there who I really liked, like Forbes Graham, really great trumpeter and electronic music musician. Brittany Carlson, a great bass player who is from around Chicago, and she's come back here a few times, and we've kind of kept up a musical connection. Quite a few other people I can mention, actually. Junko Fujiwara on cello, Kurt Newton on drums, who I had played with before, but not that much, but I played with more in Boston. I was kind of a regular member of Charlie Colhase's group called the Explorers Club. And there were some really fine musicians in that. And that was a pretty regular thing. We played regularly at the Outpost and at the Lily Pad. And right before I left town, we made a record with that group that I think will be out next year, sounds like. So yeah, I had a lot to do musically in Boston. But the venue thing is, you know, everybody who lives there and works there agrees that that's an issue and it's hard to like play as much as you'd like to. And there are ways around it and there are some opportunities that are good, but it doesn't feel really satisfactory in some ways, you know. Another thing that happened, like right before I left, was Tony Malaby moved to Boston. So he lives there and he moved to the neighborhood I was living in. And so I was starting to like hang out with him more, play sessions at his house and do some stuff together. So I was kind of, you know, that was a connection that was really nice to make. Kind of sorry to leave all these great musicians behind in a way in Boston. But my wife got a job, an all remote job. She moved to a different job that was 100% remote. And that allowed us to get out of Boston, which we kind of just felt like we couldn't afford to stay in. You know, there's no way we could afford to, I don't know, the neighborhood we were in was just getting more expensive. We could see it changing. If we had wanted to stay in the area, it would have meant going somewhere like Providence, which is definitely more affordable, but we didn't know anybody in Providence. And we do have a lot of, you know, we both had a lot of friends and connections in Chicago, so it made sense to come back here. And I mean, things have worked out well here. And, you know, I feel like it took us longer to kind of get a footing here than I kind of anticipated it would. It took me a while to find like a good practice situation. But now I have this space that I found that I'm using that's great. Couldn't be better, really. So that's, you know, allowing me to stretch out a little bit creatively. Yeah. I don't want to go on. I've already gone on too long, but I'm not going to go on longer about the process of getting back into things around here. But, you know, I'm playing with people again. There's a lot of younger musicians who I'm meeting and finding out about. A lot of people who I used to work with are still active around here. And so, yeah. I'm glad to be back. I like it here. Mm-hmm. I always liked the city. It felt like home, you know, because I spent so many years here. It feels more like home than anywhere else, really.
So maybe a bit slower of a reintegration than you were hoping for, but still, it's not like you're having to reinvent yourself in the Chicago scene.
Yeah, I knew I wasn't just going to be like stepping into what it was in 2012. You know, I had come back some during the time away. And at first coming back here kind of felt like, okay, coming back and I know what's going on. But then, especially after the whole sort of pandemic shutdown, slowdown, things like started up again and everything feels, you know, different somehow. I think that's had an effect on things that we're still trying to figure out. But I went through all that in Boston, the brunt of it, you know, this kind of like trough of the shutdown that was all in Boston, really. So, you know, it wasn't a bad place to ride that out. But then coming out of that and then moving a little over a year ago when, you know, we're still very much kind of coming out of that. I mean, even today, I wouldn't say we're out of it, really. But, you know, it's affecting touring and performing in ways that we're all still coming to terms with, I think.
Indeed. Indeed, we are in a shifting landscape week by week.
Yeah, and it's not just going back to what existed before.
Right.
You know? And, you know, I'm not going back to what existed before musically in Chicago either. So it's still a process of figuring that out.
Well, finally, I don't want to completely draw back the curtain here, if you'd rather not. But everyone knows that improvising creative musicians are not making CEO money.
Yeah.
You do a fair amount of traveling. Mm-hmm. Have you accumulated enough connections over your 30-year career with musicians who are willing to go on the road without much guarantee of making bank? I mean, how do you manage that?
Generally, if you're going to tour in Europe, it's not going to happen unless the money is going to be enough that you do okay on the tour, you know. Touring in the U.S. is something. It seems to, even before the pandemic, it was starting to get less and less financially feasible to do, you know. So if you were going to go out on tour in the U.S., at least from my perspective, there just wasn't an expectation of making as much money, you know. I don't know. I've always had this other source of income. I have this freelance translation career that I've been doing since the 90s. And it's very flexible and I do it at home. I can do it from anywhere. And so that's kind of been my answer to the money problem in this creative area. And it has drawbacks because it means I have to spend a lot of time doing this stuff that doesn't have anything to do with music. And it takes away from creative time and energy because of that. But it also means that I can take off and go on a tour and not have to worry as much about making sure that the tour having to pay enough to make it worthwhile, you know. I mean, I'm not going to go out and lose money. I don't do that. But it's okay if I make some money, you know. It's, I mean, there's no reason in talking absolute numbers here. But for example, the two tours we've done with this trombone trio in Europe have been pretty good. And that's partly been due to grant money that these guys have gotten and partly due to fees from gigs that wouldn't pay those kind of fees here. Mm-hmm. So for this tour we're doing in the US, I mean, there's no way we could do this if it was just based on fees from the gigs. So those guys both have grants that are making it possible for the tour to happen. Yeah. So that's part of the solution for this. If you're talking about all US musicians doing a US tour, I mean, yeah, the economics of it are pretty grim. You know, it's really hard to put together a tour that pays for itself with, you know, money from the shows, at least in my experience. There are probably other people you could talk to who are better at it or something, you know, than I am. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your talking about that. I know it's not, you know, it's not fun. As you say, the landscape of touring the US can be grim if you don't have alternatives. But I think it's important for people to understand, you know, what we face.
Yeah.
Doing this.
I mean, it's important if you're in this music to get it out in front of people. That means touring. And I mean, I'm willing to do that even if I don't make a ton of money at it, because it's important to me to do it and have the experience. And, you know, you learn things from touring and playing that you can't learn any other way, I think. I mean, I know musicians who feel somewhat differently about it, but without going into that, I think that, like, you can learn, it's an essential part of development in this kind of music, to travel, play for different kinds of audiences, and to deal with the stresses and the rigor of traveling and then having to play. You know, I mean, that's it trains you to have this kind of focus and to channel your energies in a certain way. I mean, I just went this past weekend. I went to Canada to the Guelph Festival to do one show, so I left on. I left on Thursday. No, I left on Friday, got there Friday evening, had a rehearsal that evening, played on Saturday evening, and then left on Sunday morning. Oh, and we actually had another little rehearsal on Saturday morning. So, you know, it's a lot of those days are complete. Those 3 days, that's a short time span of time. One set of music was totally taken up with, like, the energy flow of, like, getting to the airport, getting on the airplane, getting a ride from the airport, getting to your hotel, getting to the rehearsal, taking care of getting something to eat, getting some sleep, rehearsing again, doing a sound check, doing the gig, getting some food in there somewhere, going back to the hotel, getting up, going to the airport, coming back, you know. So that's like this. And if you're on a longer tour, it's like, you know, a string of days that are like that. Like every day you've got this, like, okay, we have to get to where we're going. We have to, like, be prepared. We have to make sure we have a place to stay. We get some food. We, you know, we also have to deal with things like trying to sell some CDs in order to try to finance the whole endeavor. So it puts you in this mindset of, like, you're really focused on this thing. And in the midst of all that, you have to keep the space open to really make the creative thing happen, to really make the music. You know, the music is not an afterthought. The music is the whole reason you're doing it, right? So you have to, it's all about that moment when you go out there and then, okay, boom, you're there in the midst of all this, and you have to, like, create the thing and create it at this really high level that justifies all of the trouble you're going to in the first place, right? So yeah, I think you learn a lot from that.
Well, Jeb Bishop, thank you so much for stopping by the show today. It's been really a great pleasure to talk to you, and we are really looking forward to this show with yourself and the two MMs from Germany.
From Cologne and Berlin, Matthias and Matthias. Thanks for having me, Michael. I really appreciate it.
That's it for this edition of the Showbiz Roundup. Our theme music is a composition by me, performed by Outside the Sphere, an experimental duo consisting of Tony Barba and myself, with special guest Sebastian Brennis on trombone. If you'd like more info about this show, you can head over to bluestemjazz.org. Be sure to check out the venue's website at audioforthearts.com. And you can follow my doings or be in touch via rattletickbuzz.com. Catch you later.